morning. On the telephone with me is Don Hubert. Don is Professor Emeritus from Purdue University. Welcome, Don.
Thank you, Pete. Appreciate being here.
Oh, appreciate having you. I was listening to an interview with you and Dr. Mercola, and something that you said that really piqued my interest, you were talking about glyphosate, which is the Roundup herbicide, is that correct?
Yes, that would be the ingredient. One of the ingredients in Roundup herbicide is glyphosate.
And you had mentioned that it's a chelator.
Yes, as a chelator, it has a very strong ability to grab on to other elements and change their solubility or their availability. With glyphosate, when it grabs on to another element, essential mineral nutrient, it immobilizes it so that it is no longer functional for those physiological processes that it would otherwise perform.
So what is the definition of a chelator?
Well, a chelator, again, is just a compound that chelation means grabbing onto.
Mm.
In a situation with glyphosate, it grabs on to essential mineral nutrients to change them so that they're immobile and no longer available to perform critical essential functions in a plant or in an animal or in humans.
So would that be essentially it'd be comparable to starving the plant?
Yes, all of our mineral nutrients are either components of tissues or they're the regulators and activators of all of our physiological processes because they serve as cofactors or those catalysts for our enzyme function. When those nutrients are chelated, those enzyme functions are turned off. It's kind of like turning the key off for an engine. The engine's still there, the enzyme's still there,
mm-hmm.
but it no longer has the power to function, that catalyst that gets it going.
So those types of catalysts, would those be the also referred to as trace elements?
Those are the trace elements. So manganese, zinc, copper, nickel, cobalt, those elements are critical as the catalyst for those enzyme functions. And so all of our herbicides, weed killers, are essentially chelators to turn off various functions in the plant. But they also function or turn off those functions in animals and humans.
So how similar are plants, animals, and humans in their physiology and their dependence on trace elements and enzymes?
We all have common as well as systems that are different. But the essential nature of the micronutrients is quite common in all species and animals and human. There would be different physiologic functions for them. For instance, a plant only has one enzyme that requires cobalt, while in animals and humans, we know that cobalt's essential is vitamin B12, which is required in a number of different functions, including liver function and immune reactions.
Are vitamins something that are found in the soil, or vitamins are created by bacteria?
Well, vitamins can be manufactured by bacteria, and also the body produces a number of some vitamins, but for us, most vitamins are preformed, or we have those essential vitamins. But again, for their formation, we require the micronutrients as a component of those vitamins or for their production.
I had asked you a question yesterday in preparation for this about B12, and I had heard that back in the 70s there was more B12 in corn plants than there is today, and you had offered a possible explanation for that.
Yes, cobalt is one of those essential nutrients that is immobilized or chelated by glyphosate, and it's very difficult to find full nutrient sufficiency of vitamin B12, not only in the plants that would be producing it, but also in liver of animals, and as an essential vitamin for immune function, when liver is analyzed in animals that are sick, very frequently we find an extreme deficiency of vitamin B12, which is a cobalt amine compound, and also an extreme deficiency of manganese, also, which is chelated and immobilized by glyphosate.
Could you explain to myself and the listeners what an amine is?
An amine is a nitrogen component, one of the units or structural components for proteins.
Mm.
It also has function in conjunction with other compounds besides the proteins, but very critical component in our physiology and also in our bodies as a constituent of proteins.
Are plants producing vitamins inside of their bodies, or is it more of a something that they're producing in the root system in partnership with bacteria?
You see it both ways. Depends on the particular vitamin. But the micronutrients are made available to the plant, or many of them have a biological cycle in the soil, so that when you have a strong chelator, and those micronutrients are immobilized, then they're not available for the plant, and quite often not available even for the bacteria or fungi that would be in the soil. There is another aspect to glyphosate that affects nutrient availability, and especially the micronutrients, iron and manganese, and that's that glyphosate is one of the most broad-spectrum antibiotics that we have also. So that it's because of its broad-spectrum chelating ability for many nutrients, it also has the ability then to have direct antibiotic effect against many organisms. These are especially our beneficial organisms in the soil or in our intestinal environment that make nutrients and vitamins available for absorption across the intestinal lining. Extremely low levels of glyphosate, levels 40 to 800 times lower than is permitted in some of our plant products, food products, is toxic to those organisms that are essential for us to have the minerals and vitamins available for us in our own physiology as well as in the plant.
So in one way, the glyphosate is preventing the plants from uptaking trace elements that would be essential to our health for us to consume them through the plant, but also can it also inhibit bacteria in our own digestive system from uptaking certain trace elements.
Yes, it's a very potent antibiotic, patented for that purpose also, as well as an herbicide that changes the microflora or that biological component in our intestinal tract, just like it does in animals or in the soil. The other change is that it is somewhat selective in that many of our pathogens, Clostridium species, number of other very serious pathogens, disease-causing organisms, are not sensitive to glyphosate. In other words, when you remove the beneficial organisms, then these very pathogenic organisms, disease organisms, like Salmonella and E. coli and Clostridium botulinum, are essentially stimulated to become much more damaging to us in our own system.
So the glyphosate essentially is killing off the beneficial bacteria, and the things that are left are the ones that are more harmful to us.
Yes, actually that's the way it works as a weed killer, is that the glyphosate shuts down the plant's defense mechanisms to these disease organisms that are in the soil, but then it also kills off the beneficial organisms that would normally control those soil-borne pathogens, and it stimulates the pathogens, and it's actually the pathogens that kill the weeds as an herbicide.
Mm-hmm. So it's not the product itself that's killing them. Well, I mean, it's very indirect.
Right. It's an indirect mechanism, but a very powerful one, so that it's been a very powerful herbicide, but it's also a very powerful antibiotic to change the total environment, biological environment, in the soil and in our own intestine and stomach.
Do you know if the antibiotics that are used for humans are working through the same chelation method, or are they working through a different mechanism?
There are several mechanisms that are involved. Tetracycline, for instance, works through chelation, very much like glyphosate does.
That's very interesting. I had hardly heard anything about chelation before I heard your interview, so this is all coming as fascinating news to me.
Well, rather than talk about chelation and that, what we usually do is identify the enzyme system or systems that are shut down because of a mobilization of those critical catalysts or cofactors that are required for those enzymes. So for glyphosate, you'll commonly hear them refer to the EPSPS enzyme being inhibited. However, just inhibiting the EPSPS enzyme won't kill a plant. You can't kill a plant in sterile soil. It's the pathogens that do the killing after you've applied the glyphosate.
So I've heard you compare this to make a possible analogy here to AIDS, that this is like how AIDS depletes a person's immune response. It's not exactly, but it's comparable in the plant.
Yes, we don't have an immune system, but we have defense mechanisms in the plant against these soil-borne pathogens, and what glyphosate does is shut down all of those defense reactions so that the plant tissue then just becomes a good nutrient source, and we scoot the chair up to the table for dinner. But it essentially, glyphosate essentially gives the plant a bad case of AIDS, if we wanted an analogy there.
Right. How many enzyme systems have been identified in plants?
Oh, I can't give you the exact number. There are over 800 that are require just magnesium. You have 28 for that require manganese, a number of enzymes for each of the trace elements. I can't pull off the top of my head the exact, the total number, but it's many enzymes that are required because we have an interdependent system in the plant or in our own bodies that require these stepwise processes to give us the nutrition and the structural components and functional components that we require for life or for function.
How many trace elements are inhibited by glyphosate?
Glyphosate is a chelator or immobilizes all of the cations. It's a stronger chelator for the divalent. That would be your copper, manganese, zinc, iron, cobalt, nickel. Those elements are very strongly chelated by glyphosate. Potassium is much lower in its chelation stability constant. But any of the positively charged mineral elements can be chelated by glyphosate.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it different from all of our other herbicides, because most of our other herbicides are much more specific, much narrower band. We have those that would be just specific for certain enzymes requiring a specific micronutrient as a cofactor or a catalyst. But with glyphosate, we see it's a very broad spectrum. So even though we talk about inhibiting EPSPS enzyme, which it does, it also inhibits 20 other enzymes that are involved in our physiologic functioning.
Mm-hmm. How do scientists figure out when they have a new herbicide is introduced? How do they go about figuring out what the mechanism is that's causing it to cause the different herbs to die off?
Well, with most of our herbicides that have been registered, that process had to be identified before it would be registered, so that we look for those specific enzymes that are required in overall physiologic processes that are going on in the plant and identify those steps that are then inhibited. Symptoms give us a good indicator of what enzyme or what micronutrients are involved or what enzymes might be involved. So if a plant turns yellow,
mm-hmm.
Magnesium and manganese are required for photosynthesis. Iron is required, for energy transfer, and nitrogen, of course, for the amino acids and formation of the enzymes. So we can look at symptoms and have an idea of where to look initially, but then we need to look at those specific enzymes and follow those through as to what is actually inhibiting them. Even as late as 1995, 20 years after glyphosate was commercialized as an herbicide, it was still listed as an inhibitor of the EPSPS enzyme system, but actual mode of action as an herbicide was listed as unknown. So it's taken many years to appreciate how powerful a chelator it is, because it's not just one system that's shut down. It literally shuts down many of those enzyme systems because it immobilizes many of those essential micronutrients that the plant and animals and humans require.
I know that many people now realize the danger or the toxicity of DDT after all these years, but I did hear you say that you believe that glyphosate is worse than DDT. Can you explain that to the listeners?
Well, as a very broad-spectrum chelator, glyphosate affects many systems. It's not just one or two systems that are involved or enzymes that are involved. It actually has a very subtle but very dynamic effect on many different systems. So we see those effects manifest over a long period of time as being very deleterious or very detrimental to our overall health, because we see not only the mineral deficiency in our food and in our for crop production, but also for animal production and human health. You have iron that's required for blood function. You have magnesium and copper for brain function, vitamin B12 or cobalt, and manganese for liver function and immune reactions. That all of these different systems are impacted dynamically by glyphosate.
Mm. Are enzymes something that usually happen within the organism, or are enzymes something the organism needs to take in from outside of itself?
Enzymes in our microorganisms are synthesized by the organism. Most of the enzymes that are really active in our body are also synthesized. Now, we can extract those. Some of them are very stable enzymes, and we can actually do some enzyme therapy and that to compensate for some of the damage that might be done to those enzyme systems in our body or also in the plant. In the plant, it's we rely on the microorganisms. It's not economically feasible for us to go around spraying on enzymes, mm-hmm. for the most part, but we can change the biological component in the soil and have a very dynamic effect then on enzyme function that's also going on in the soil because of changes in those microorganisms. Very much like a probiotic would be for an animal or for a human.
So are there probiotics that are used in the agricultural world?
Yes, in animal production, there are quite a few probiotics. In fact, their use is becoming more critical because of the residual levels of glyphosate that we're finding in our food and feed. So that they can be used and have been used for a number of years to enhance growth or animal milk production, some of those things, by making those vitamins and minerals more available to the animal. But what we do in crop production is we change the soil environment to favor those organisms that would accomplish that for us rather than actually providing the organism. Although we do provide the organisms, I guess if you look at nitrogen fixation, symbiotic nitrogen fixation, that might be somewhat analogous to a probiotic, where we're actually adding the organism to the environment so that it's available then for that synergistic relationship with the plant to fix atmospheric nitrogen and provide the benefit that we receive from it.
You talked about the difference between, could you tell us the difference between phosphate versus phosphite?
Well, phosphate is has four oxygens. That's the form of phosphorus that we require and animals and plants require. If there's one less oxygen available, in other words, a PO3 rather than a PO4, if it's a phosphite rather than a phosphate, is very poorly available or limited availability for the plant and can actually compete with phosphorus uptake. So that glyphosate is a phosphonate or a phosphite. It's an organic phosphorus chemical, but as a phosphite, it can actually compete with the phosphate that is required physiologically by plants, animals, and humans. And the higher residual levels of glyphosate that we're finding in our air and water and food all has that effect, not just as a chelator, but also as a competitor for this anion phosphate that we require for life to continue.
Just one more reason, glyphosate is problematic.
Yeah, but excuse me, I didn't hear that, Pete.
Oh, that would be just one more reason why glyphosate is such a problem for us.
Yes, it has such a broad spectrum of activity impacting essentially all of the functions that we rely on for proper health, as well as defense against the many disease organisms that are present in the environment.
I have a specific application question for you. We have a farm. We don't use chemical fertilizers or chemical pesticides, but there's a farm that's adjacent to us, and there's drainage tiles under that field about 3 feet down, and it drains into a pond. Do you think that all these chemical fertilizers are making it into the pond? And if so, is there a type of test to test for pesticides and herbicides in your pond water?
There are tests available, and recently, in the last few years, we have some very sensitive tests for glyphosate. In the past, it's a very simple compound, but a very difficult compound to test for. In the past, we now have some very sensitive tests that are giving us a much greater understanding of how perverse this compound really is in the environment. But glyphosate is a very highly water-soluble compound. The U.S. Geological Survey also finds that it's in very clinically significant concentrations just in our air.
Wow.
And after each rain, it's flushed down into the water system. But it's very strong chelating abilities mean that it's detoxified quite readily through that chelation with calcium, magnesium, and iron and manganese, the other mineral elements, but it's very difficult compound to degrade in many soils, so that it's also very persistent. Its degradation is very similar to DDT, which you mentioned. It can have a very long half-life into many years in the soil and in certain soils. Generally detoxified through its chelation. That chelation and that detoxification can be broken, and it can then be what we call desorbed from the soil, again active and available then for chelating and direct toxicity to plants several years later in the cropping system even.
Is there a difference which soil holds it longer, whether you're a clay soil or sandy soil?
Two things that determine sorption of glyphosate in the soil are soil pH, so that it's held longer in the soil at a lower pH, anything below a 6.5, and also the more higher the clay content in the soil will also give greater persistence of the glyphosate because it removes it from access to those soil microbes that would have the potential for degrading it. Again, very much, very similar persistence-wise in many situations to what we would see with DDT.
Mm-hmm.
And that long-term accumulation, we have several situations where we've been able to detect 100% of the glyphosate, essentially, that's been applied over a 9 or a 10 year period. It's a matter of just having the proper techniques to analyze for it, which in the past we hadn't had, but again, with the ELISA techniques and some of those now, we can detect those levels that are severely damaging to both our intestinal microflora and also to the soil biota.
So is there much study or speculation on how much glyphosate is in people's drinking wells, water wells?
There are areas where that's measured. U.S. Geological Survey published a paper this last summer on 8 river basin areas, water supply there, and found clinically significant levels, those levels that we know can have an effect on our intestinal microflora. That predisposes to disease or that can have some direct effects on our tissue from recent studies that have been made, so that they found very significant levels in both the air and on water supply for those 8 river basin aquifers that they studied. So the Argentine doctors held their first conference where they've been studying the effect of drift glyphosate in the air from agricultural areas into urban areas, and they're reporting an increase in birth defects as much as 447% increase in birth defects, childhood cancer, many other health effects just from drift from agricultural areas and where they've used the glyphosate, even though these people in the urban areas don't have a direct exposure to the pesticide. It's in the air and the water, as U.S. Geological Survey study has shown.
Do you know if it's common for physicians who are seeing patients to make these correlations between their patients who may have a farm field directly in their backyard or something like that when they're looking at people's different types of chronic illnesses that are, not commonly explained?
I think I can say that probably most physicians don't have a clue. It's been promoted and marketed as such a safe product, and I know I've heard people even say that it's the safe, you can drink it. Well, it's also probably the most common suicide chemical that you have in South America and Asia, because it doesn't take very much of it, and it's readily available there, but it's a very potent chelator again, so it just shuts down many of those physiologic systems that we require. But that's not what you read when you go into the look at the farm magazines, or you go into the grocery store, and many of these grocery stores or any farm store, or you can find a jug of glyphosate sitting there for sale. It's advertised safe for your driveway or your garden or for your crops. And FDA and EPA haven't required warning labels on it, other than just normal, you know, wear some gloves and protect yourself, and very minimal protection that's even listed on it by comparison to its broad spectrum effects. It's just that it doesn't have that acute activity, that very quick activity. It's a very subtle, kind of a Trojan horse type of a situation, where you have something that can be used, and it could be a very powerful tool to use, but it can also be a very dangerous fire when it's excessively used, as we see, and in many cases just it's absolute abuse. In my opinion, when we look at how it's used and how it's just dumped on our soils, especially as we see resistant weeds, and seeing anywhere from 3 to 5 times as much material now required as it would have been with any other pesticide.
It also seems that the danger here is that it's how dangerous the chemical isn't realized, so people are very... people are not cautious using it, and very liberal with the application. Would that be correct?
Yes. It's promoted and marketed so heavily that people just assume it's safety, and the health effects from it generally don't show up for years. A very recent paper, in fact, it's the only scientific study that's been done more than 90 days that I'm aware of with rats, and this one shows that the breast cancer, liver damage, kidney damage, that type of damage isn't observed until about 120 days. So all of the safety studies that have been conducted have been very short duration, which would miss the very dynamic or very drastic effects of this compound over time, and where we're essentially exposed to it on a constant basis. It means then that time factor is additive for us, and damage then continues to develop and build up. And when I see these ads on TV about mesothelioma, you don't get lung cancer and that from or immediately with exposure to the asbestos. It's a long-term type effect, and these studies are showing that that's the consequence of the excessive use of glyphosate in our own system. And if there are a number of diseases that we see tracking very, very closely to the adoption of our genetically engineered crops and the excessive use of glyphosate. And we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg for those diseases now that are all impacted by those residual levels of glyphosate in our environment.
Let me take this opportunity to tell the listeners, if you're out there and you have a question for Don Hubert and you want to reach us here in the studio, the telephone number is area code 315-859-4200. Again, that number is 315-859-4200. Don, with Fusarium, is that when you see an orange coloration to roots, where roots are rotted away, or is that a different disease?
It depends on the crop. On corn with one species of Fusarium, Fusarium graminearum, infection by that fungus will give you a purple or a red colored root quite often. Also, you can see that in the corn stalk as the disease moves up into the stalk. Those lower stalk nodes will also become kind of a purple. There's another form of Fusarium, the Fusarium manilliformi, that has more of a pink color, very light salmon pink type of a color in its infection, but it's more infection of the ear than the stalk tissues with the manilliformi. You get those pigments forming because you have a change in the physiology of the plant, and it's indicating what that physiologic change is that the fungus is causing.
I was thinking of parsley and celery. I'll see the roots getting orange on those and look kind of rotted away. I don't know if that's something that you study, those crops.
Good. Again, Fusarium species and most of the Fusaria infect a large number of plants. They're not. It's perhaps our most serious overall pathogen. I know other plant pathologists would argue, depending on which one they're working with and experiencing the most problem with their particular crops. But there are several pathogens and several bacteria that could also give you that orange color when they macerate or when they rot the tissues there. But Fusarium would be a common one, yes.
Well, you also study remediation. So what are some of the factors that are necessary for healthy crop production once people drop the glyphosate?
Well, of course, most of our stresses and diseases have a tie to nutrition. Not that we can totally offset all of that damage, but maintaining adequate nutrition is kind of the step one for remediation. To do that, we need to recognize that that we have a compound which is a very strong chelator. And quite often we'll find that even though we have the mineral elements, those micronutrients in the plant, their efficiency is greatly reduced because of the residual glyphosate that's also present. So that quite often we have to increase the level of nutrient. We used to look at that range of for different crops that we see in our textbooks and tables for sufficiency, and for corn, for instance, that ranges from 25 part per million to 300. And you say, well, why such a big range? Well, that range is because we have environmental factors that determine its the function of that nutrient or its full availability. If it's going to be 100% available, it would be towards the lower end of that range. But if we're in a glyphosate environment or where we're using a lot of glyphosate herbicide, even for our Roundup Ready crops, it becomes much more important for us then to look at remediation by providing those nutrients that might show up in tissue tests as being there, but they're not physiologically available or utilized as efficiently in those plants as they would have been in the absence of the glyphosate. So the first thing would be to make sure that we have a full sufficiency of the nutrients. We're seeing a lot more common deficiency of nickel and cobalt than we used to just say, well, they have we have enough contaminant or it's spreading enough in the soil that we don't have to worry about some of those. But with the chelating immobilization and change in the biological component of the soil, we're finding that a lot of those nutrients now have to be supplied, and some of them, the most efficient way is through a foliar application to kind of bypass that immobilization that takes place in the soil. The second consideration, if we're looking at a Roundup Ready plant or a genetically modified plant, is to recognize that those plants also have a reduced efficiency for many of the nutrients, so that they require a higher tissue levels for full function than their normal component without those genetic modification. So that, if you have a genetically engineered crop that you're growing and also have use of the glyphosate, then the requirement for a lot of these micronutrients, especially manganese and iron, go up proportionately or considerably in that production. If we had a way to choose from our own health, which we don't have at the current time because nothing's labeled, but certainly the glyphosate residues are can be quite high in many of our crops. You can have 20 parts per million in wheat and barley, peas and soybeans. You can have up to 400 parts per million in Roundup Ready alfalfa. And yet, a lot of the clinical studies show that a half a part per million are from an intestinal antibiotic standpoint, one part per billion is enough to be toxic to our intestinal microflora. So the levels that are in our food are much higher. Our mineral deficiencies are also becoming greater in our society as we see both a reduced availability in our food and feed, as well as reduced efficiency in our own physiology because of that residual glyphosate that we're consuming on a regular basis.
I had met a woman who took over a farm. It used to be a big field that was heavily sprayed with atrazine. And she had mentioned someone telling them to plant locust trees, and somehow locust trees would help to remediate some of that. Would you be familiar what the theory is there or how that would be working?
I'm not familiar with that specific example, but there are a number of ways to remediate that biological component or to remove unwanted elements from the soil through trap cropping or growing a high accumulating plant species to remove it from the soil. And I don't know what in that particular situation, whether it's changing the soil microflora like we do with crop sequence and crop rotation, or whether it's a matter of hyperaccumulation of the atrazine to pull it out of the soil.
I did hear the trees themselves are nitrogen fixing. I don't know if that's part of how it works.
I don't know of the tie between the nitrogen fixing and the atrazine uptake there. I'm not familiar with that specific situation.
Another question I had for you is, we know that there's certain plants that are higher in certain minerals than others. So let's say there's a particular plant that comes from Japan, Ashitaba, which is supposed to be high in B12. Would that mean that plant has more resistance to the chelation, or how do certain plants become higher in certain trace elements than others?
They can do that through root configuration. They're better scavengers, but most of it is through the physiologic processes for nutrient uptake. For instance, our oat varieties have been bred for efficiency for manganese uptake, because that gives them a resistance to manganese deficiency. We have a lot of plants will produce ferric reductase, an enzyme that is released into the soil to convert unavailable iron to an available form. And in those plants that are high accumulators, we find that the physiologic processes are available in those plants for more efficient uptake, and also the biological root exudates that go out into the soil change the soil biota, the soil microflora in the root system, to also benefit them, or some plants that can actually change it in some soils to make it those nutrients less available. An example of the latter would be in southwest Indiana. We have a situation where our growers will grow melons on the same soil that they're growing wheat. Melons, again, have that ability to accumulate the micronutrients very efficiently and can actually pull up nutrients, manganese levels that can be toxic to the plant unless they lime the soil or reduce that availability. And yet when you grow wheat on that same soil, which is a very poor manganese accumulator, it can be extremely manganese deficient and have severe take-all root rot because of that manganese deficiency. So there are very large differences in different plant species, but also in different varieties. So in the breeding program for soybeans, for instance, we would see soybean varieties that would have very severe manganese deficiency up in northwest Indiana, and other varieties would be able to tolerate those deficiencies because they were more efficient in taking up the micronutrients and were able to perform very well in those low manganese soils. I could mention that we we do have specific foods that are higher in some nutrients than in other nutrients, and your nuts and some of those things, peanuts, for instance, generally much higher in manganese than walnuts would be, and you see that different efficiency or different crops because of that ability to accumulate specific nutrients, and that's why we have a little bit of variety in our diet to make sure we get all of the nutrients that we need.
I see. The question I had was about the foliar feed you were mentioning. Is that something that's coming from sea minerals, or is that something that's coming from, I've heard of people using volcanic ash that has a lot of trace elements to it. Where are the trace elements coming from that you use in the foliar feed?
Well, commercially, most of it is used as a nutrient itself from an inorganic source, just because that's the cheaper sources. Organic ash and a number of organic, there are a number of organic sources for many of these micronutrients. They're just not as efficient to utilize over a large acreage as you would find with the inorganic salts that we commercially use more than the other. With manure, we're recycling them, usually in a fairly available form there also.
Have you done much study of mycorrhizal inoculation of the soil?
Yes, that hasn't been a specific area, but it's one when you look at microbial ecology, you can't ignore, and also certain plants are very dependent on the mycorrhizae. Mycorrhizae are critical element, again, for phosphorus and for zinc uptake especially, but they'll also increase the uptake of some of the other micronutrients. Mycorrhizae are quite sensitive to glyphosate, so that we lose a lot of that benefit with our high usage and residual levels of glyphosate in our soils.
And have you heard of a product called Actinovate? It's a foliar spray that's a type of a foliar probiotic.
I haven't.
That's something that we have used on the farm, and we've had good results treating our spinach for Fusarium wilt.
Okay. I'm not familiar with the brand name there, but there are a number of products that show protection and benefit in those areas.
Is there
Wade Elmer at the University of Connecticut has done a lot of work in that area. There are some very excellent research in those areas.
Is there a study on which microbials produce which vitamins?
There are. I don't know of a single source reference right off, and I've been more focused on the biological interactions from just the mineral standpoint more than the vitamin complex interactions there, but they're very specific organisms for manganese and iron, and those would be the two very critical ones that we find a strong biological component in the soil. In fact, for manganese uptake, it's almost totally determined by the activity of those soil microorganisms in the root zone. And we manage the microorganisms rather than managing the nutrient directly. For manganese, for iron, it's not, it has about the same dynamics, but a little different manipulation, that we would use in our agricultural program. And when we're farming, we're really managing an ecology. Sometimes we look at our pesticides as silver bullets, but you have to realize that any time we make one change in the production system, we change a lot of other interacting factors, and that's one of the things that we've ignored or forgotten about with the glyphosate, with its very broad spectrum and scope of effects in that environment.
I've taken you off on many tangents here. You were beginning to explain remediation and that the first step is to get proper nutrition to your crops. What is recommended after that?
Well, of course, proper nutrition. We know that tillage, it doesn't have to be moldboard plowing and that, but just stirring the soil every once in a while has a big effect on that soil microflora that can increase the availability of iron and manganese, for instance. And those are two of them that in a long-term no-till we tend to see a change that limits the availability of those essential nutrients in some of our soils, and once in a while going through and just opening the soil to get some oxygen in or to change that environment. Timing becomes important on that. Usually in our North American environment, fall tillage would have more advantage in giving us the change in that biological component than the spring tillage, but it depends on your soil and your area. A little bit of tillage in certain situations becomes very helpful and beneficial for us. You also see the benefit there from residue decomposition. And if it's important that we recycle a lot of those nutrients that are tied up in our residue, and we find with our heavy glyphosate use that a lot of those organisms that used to break down the residue just don't exist in the soil environment anymore. An antibiotic effect has taken those organisms out of the environment, and we're seeing some benefit from remediation by adding those organisms back to the environment. You mentioned your kind of probiotic on your spinach, that we're seeing that becoming more beneficial for us all the time because we don't have those organisms present. Those organisms that used to protect the leaf surface from Salmonella and E. coli, we also find are very sensitive to glyphosate, so that the pathogens can survive and become a problem for us then from a food standpoint or contamination. But remediation, biological remediation, is also becoming more important for us, as well as just the direct nutrient remediation in those areas. I think if I was looking at any one single factor relative to glyphosate, it would be a very judicious use of it And with the contamination that we have in the environment, and also the loss of its effectiveness as an herbicide with our resistant weeds, a move to alternative herbicides as quickly as we can would be in the best interests of everyone.
Mm. You had mentioned in another interview about using co-metabolism for something like glyphosate that's very difficult to degrade. Could you speak a little about that?
Yes, it's there are a few organisms that can directly degrade glyphosate. As I indicated, it's a very simple compound. It's just an amino acid and a phosphite, or a phosphonate, as we refer to it chemically, but very difficult to degrade. Its first degradation product is actually more toxic than the glyphosate is, the AMPA, but its primary mode of degradation is similar to DDT, and that's through co-metabolism. In other words, the organism that produces the enzymes to break it down isn't receiving any direct benefit that we're aware of in that degradation. It just happens to produce the enzyme for decarboxylation or other route that brings about its degradation. But the organism itself doesn't receive any direct benefit, and so we refer to that as co-metabolism. And that's the primary way in most of our soils that we see degradation of glyphosate. It's not as predictable and, of course, not as efficient as we would see with organisms that can actually degrade it. There's some research going on in a number of areas to actually select organisms that can degrade glyphosate efficiently. A few of those products are just starting to get close to commercialization, but we could also do that by modifying the environment biologically through tillage and some of those things, although we don't see increased degradation of glyphosate by tillage in the studies that have been done. The other surprising thing is that we don't see organic matter as a significant factor in increasing degradation. That's a surprise, because usually when we increase organic matter, we increase microbial activity. But the activity that's increased in the studies, at least, that have gone on so far that I'm aware of, haven't shown an increased degradation of glyphosate. If you have a lot of nutrients in that organic matter, you'll see immobilization of the glyphosate, because it's a strong chelator, so that you can reduce the toxicity and gain some benefits that way more than perhaps through direct degradation.
So does that, would that conclude all of the steps that you would use in remediation?
Yes, that would be making sure that you provide full nutrient sufficiency, compensate for that reduced efficiency from the glyphosate or from the genetic engineering, which can be every bit as powerful a reduction as the glyphosate. And then the biological remediation, of course, the other remediation factor would be to make sure that it stays chelated, keep it immobilized in the soil so that it isn't desorbed at a later time to come back and haunt us. And then the more judicious, much more judicious use are switched to an alternative herbicide. When we were working on the citrus variegated chlorosis disease in Brazil, very serious vascular bacterial disease, we found we had very little success in controlling that disease until we eliminated glyphosate as an herbicide, because it had such a profound effect on nutrient uptake and availability for the plant to defend itself. Once we removed the glyphosate from the environment, it was just a matter of 2 or 3 years before Shioshi Yamada and the international group of scientists that he had put together working on that disease were able to completely reverse the effects of it and restore production not only to its previous level, but also to another 10 or 15% improvement in yield, because there are other diseases that were controlled by just removing the glyphosate. Again, glyphosate stimulates those soil-borne pathogens, Fusarium, Rhizoctonia, Pythium, and Phytophthora, that are the reason why it's an herbicide. And when you stimulate those pathogens, we create super pathogens then that affect other crops later on in the rotation, long after we've grown our Roundup Ready crop.
Now, is there anything I haven't asked you about that you'd like to speak about before we depart today?
Well, there are some very serious consequences that we're becoming aware of now with our excessive use of glyphosate, and also with the genetically engineered crops. And the only study, long-term study, and this is a two-year study, that has ever been conducted and is in a peer-reviewed scientific journal is the recent study that was just released of Cirillini and his group from University of Caen in France. Very thorough, very detailed, very well thought out approach that gives us an explanation for many of those diseases that, and conditions that we're seeing in our society on an escalating basis. So that there are other studies now that show the correlations and show the effects on other diseases. So Cirillini's is just the tip of the iceberg. If you look at the increase in frequency of autism, of inflammatory bowel disease, leaky gut disease, gluten intolerance, any of all of those diseases that are influenced by our functionality of our intestinal microflora that are all being disrupted by residual glyphosate in our food products and in our environment, we see a direct correlation, and the research now is just starting to connect the dots between the glyphosate and the GMO crops and a number of these other diseases, in addition to those that are so well documented and a causal relationship to glyphosate and the GMO crops with in the Cirillini study. So that's just the tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. I think that future historians, as I've commented before, will probably look back upon our time, and they won't write about how many pounds of pesticide we did or didn't apply, but they'll write about how willing we are to sacrifice our children and future generations by this massive experiment that we have now that's essentially based on failed promises and flawed science just to benefit the the bottom line of a commercial enterprise. I think we're going to see that continuing documentation now as we see the research finally being initiated that should have been conducted 30 years ago on these products. So I appreciate the opportunity to share with you not just my research, but the research of many other scientists. I just tried to pull it together here a little bit, hope that it hasn't been too disjunctured in that capacity.
I don't think so. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your information with all of us.
Okay. Thanks, Pete. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
So we just heard from Don Hubert, Professor Emeritus, Purdue University, and talked a lot about the problems with using glyphosate and how it's going to affect the soil, the crops, and the people. So thank you for listening. This will be archived. If you'd like to get on the mailing list, I do send out an email a few days before each interview to let listeners know who will be on next. You're welcome to call me here in the studio and give me your contact information. The phone number here is 859-4200, 859-4200. And next week, my guest will be speaking about the book, The Calcium Paradox, vitamin K2, and how this little known vitamin could save your life. Next, we're going to be listening to Teaching Children Permaculture with Kelly Hogan.